طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Each year, the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University honors the late Hilda Silverman, a beloved activist for Palestinian rights, in a lecture series named in her honor. This morning on This Week in Palestine, we bring you this year's memorial lecture given by Martha Myers, an American-born woman who has spent her life working with a variety of organizations throughout the Middle East. She married a Palestinian man, lived in Gaza initially, raised four children, and before then working in development organizations throughout the Middle East. The lecture constitutes the entire program this morning. Here is Martha Myers delivering the 6th annual Hilda B. Silverman Lecture at Harvard University.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm going to have to beg the indulgence of all of you. I'm recovering from a cold, so I apologize in advance. Thanks again, Sarah. I don't think I've ever felt so accomplished. I don't recognize myself. I was lucky all those years ago to have been acquainted with Hilda Silverman, a woman brimming with a sense of practical energy and compassion. Having had this acquaintance, I feel a sense of wonderment and humility to be invited to give this lecture today. I've been asked to talk to you today about my experience as a woman living and working in the Middle East for the past 40 years. So this lecture is quite personal. I am sharing my personal views, experiences, and observations. In these four decades, I have lived in Palestine for the most, but also the Sultanate of Oman, Jordan, and Egypt. For more than 3 years, I have been living in Turkey in order to work on Syria, and therefore within the Syrian refugee community. I have worked in Lebanon and Yemen as well. I was married, bore and raised children, and was divorced in the region. I have been through a lot. The Arab Middle East, and I want to be clear, I am only talking about the Arab Middle East and not Turkey or Iran. The Arab Middle East is not a good place for a woman on the surface of things, right? We all know that. Let me review some of the realities. The Middle East is a region of dismal human development and gender equity profiles. Women in the Arab region are, on average, disadvantaged economically, politically, and socially compared to women in all other regions, including sub-Saharan Africa. Considering oil and the urbanization of the region, the literacy and educational attainment rates are comparatively low for Arab women. Women are extremely poorly represented in governance and decision-making positions in both the political and economic spheres. Family or personal status laws legislatively relegate women to a dependent status in marriage, divorce, child custody, and inheritance. In some countries, these restrictions go further, preventing a woman from traveling without the permission of a male guardian, or to travel with her children, or without the permission of her husband. inheritance laws based on Islamic law stipulate inheritance for women, but at 50% of the male portion. This poses a relative disadvantage to women in terms of their access to capital. Everywhere in the world, labor roles are engendered. But in the Middle East, these divisions are particularly resilient. Valentine Mukaddam has aptly characterized this as a kind of patriarchal gender contract. Arab women are a small, tiny proportion of the workforce. The cumulative effect is gender-based discrimination and second-class citizenship for women, albeit in varying degrees across the countries of the region. The World Economic Forum Global Gender Gap Report for 2016 measures on an annual basis the equity gap between men and women in their respective countries in four domains: economy, education, health, and politics. It confirms the bleak picture for women in the Middle East region. Out of 144 countries globally, Lebanon is 135, Jordan 134, Egypt 132, Saudi Arabia 141, Syria 142, Tunisia 126, Yemen 144th out of 144, right at the bottom of the pile, Oman 133, Kuwait 128. In sum, we all know that Arab women are disempowered and that every day of their lives, a man makes decisions for them in terms of what they will wear, where they may go, if they may study, whom they shall marry, whether or not they may divorce, or choose to limit family size or control birth spacing. It's terrible, right? No place to raise a daughter. Thank heavens, the Arabs have people like me to come with gender mainstreaming and gendered programming, gender analysis to fix things for them and to make them in my own image. Because, of course, my own image is great, right? Let's look at where I come from, the United States. The CDC National Violence Against Women Survey estimates that 5.3 million intimate partner violence victimizations occur among U.S. women ages 18 and older every year. This results in 2 million injuries, more than 500,000 of which require medical attention. IPV victims also lose a total of 8 million days of paid work, the equivalent of 32,000 full-time jobs, and nearly 5.6 million days of household productivity as a result of the violence. On average, three women in the United States are killed every day in intimate partner violence. A total of 1,500 women, on average, a year, are killed by a family member. One in six American women have been raped. Let's talk about pay. American women, according to the Institute for Women's Policy Research, are almost half of the workforce and are the sole or co-breadwinner in half of American families with children. Although we are better educated than our male counterparts, we still earn less than men, 80 cents on the dollar as an average. That means from mid-October to New Year's Eve, I am working for free compared to the guy next to me. It's even bleaker in the middle skill occupations, where jobs usually done by women bring home 66 cents on the dollar as compared to jobs usually encumbered by men. Compare these numbers to Lebanon, 61 cents on the dollar, or Tunisia, 65 cents on the dollar. Are we so very different? So what am I trying to say here? What I'm saying is that women's inequality, inequity between genders, and female relative disempowerment and disenfranchisement is a global reality and not just a feature of the Arab world. The Middle East, for a whole range of reasons that are beyond the purview of this talk, performs worst as compared to all other regions in terms of overall equity scores. And yes, of critical and related importance, women in all Middle Eastern countries are severely disadvantaged by unfair and unequal laws and policies. But to only understand what it is to be a woman in the Middle East through this lens is monochromatic, ignoring the complexity of culture, society, and human interaction in the region. I work in development and humanitarian assistance and emergency response. I can tell you that for decades now, assistance funding has come with solemn caveats about mainstreaming gender. The former head of UN Women and now president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, once said in a meeting I attended that in her view, gender mainstreaming meant doing nothing about gender. Donors insist on gender disaggregated statistics and that women must be, quote unquote, represented. They promulgate serious policies on the topic, all to very uncertain impact ends. This well enough meaning Western agenda is ramping up and becoming more assertive. Of course, I do feel that funding and resources skillfully directed to members of the community like women who might not otherwise have access is desirable. It's fair. And of course, I recognize that as men and women experience the world differently, the best assistance programming will be calibrated to mold to those different realities. I also support resources to support those in the Arab societies who are debating and advocating for more equity. But I have two concerns. First, we are not the only ones on the planet who wish to protect civilization as we know it. Western gender agendas are fundamentally grounded in a view that the way we live is the right way, and the way other people live needs to be fixed. The pushing of an agenda which many Arabs, men and women, see as inimical to their way of life can actually do damage to the question of fairness and to those who are working, for example, to address personal status issues like a woman's right to the custody of her children or to transmit her citizenship to her children. Very often, I fear, we do not get over the minimum bar of do no harm. Let's be honest. In the Arab world, the West is generally viewed with a well-earned skepticism. Indeed, we have colonized, expropriated, upheld repressive dictatorships, steadfastly backed the occupation of Palestine, invaded, bombed, and generally meddled. The apparent hypocrisy of our shock at ISIS beheadings and our acquiescence to Saudi beheadings, our concern about the status of women in the region when our very best friend, Saudi Arabia, denies women control over their lives in almost every single way, these things are lost on no one. So when we come calling, wishing to roll up our sleeves and delve into the intimacy of home, family, human relationships, and to improve things for women in the Middle East, we are certainly seen as something less than a skilled and honest broker. My second concern is related to a favorite quote of mine. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens advised that one should understand before disagreeing. Before pushing to remake Middle Eastern societies in our own image in regard to gender relations, or, in the marginally better case, advocating change, we need to understand the Arab world. And what do I think our pushing a Western feminist agenda misses? It misses that the Middle East is radically different than the West, and people view themselves and their world in a wholly different way. I believe it is important to remember that for the most part, social systems are set up to mitigate conflict and protect people. Before we start trying to tear apart social fabrics that we see as patriarchal and disempowering, we should look at things from a protection lens. Instead of analyzing, for example, a very common course of events in the Arab world, that a girl goes from her father's house to her husband's house. Instead of analyzing it as if some kind of chain of custody transaction was taking place, and drawing the conclusion that she is merely chattel, let's consider what protection this system provides the individual in terms of her educational and economic opportunities. Let's consider what social and psychological support she is experiencing, encompassed by a family who will continue to love and afford protection as she starts her married life. Let's consider that for most people in the Arab world, the idea of living alone and separated from family is not a norm. It's an anathema. In fact, to me, the saddest women in the Arab world are precisely those in places where all the traditional social protections are being ripped away by global economy, war, occupation, and urban migration. And there is no substitute safety net. Now, of course, I am generalizing. The Arab world is not uniform. It is just the opposite. Different countries have different histories, experiences, and exposures. They have had different leaderships. Class differences matter. Religious diversity matters. Not just whether you are Christian, Muslim, or Druze, or one of the plethora of variables within those categories, but whether as a Sunni Muslim, for example, you are a Bedouin, urban dweller, or rural peasant. To which of the Islamic schools of law does your particular cohort adhere? How is your particular slice of life impacted by the forces that are driving what we call radicalization and Salafism? In my experience, a significant driver of the movement towards radicalization, as we in the West like to call it when referring to other countries, is the sense, reinforced by reality, that grave injustices have been visited upon one and one's community, and that the world is either indifferent or actually participatory. Injustice, real and perceived, can cause a retreat into some imagined moral order of the past. Does that sound familiar? We're calling it populism here just now. This may sound like a digression from the topic, but it is not. This sense that one's world, identity, security, and ability to navigate are under sustained pressure and attack is highly germane to women and their possibilities in the Middle East. All these differences are at play as one talks about the experience of a woman in the Arab world. And then, of course, individual personalities and socialized expectations come into play. In thinking about being a woman in the Arab world and the position of women, I prefer to steer away from the rather voyeuristic harem, veil, subjugation stereotypes, and to point to what I think is a very important reality. The Arab world, generalizing, is a world constructed on the pillars of community. It is not a place, by and large, where people have the appreciation of individualism and the different drummer that characterizes our own society. Of course, a community construct, as opposed to an individual construct, profoundly informs how people see themselves. It influences how they evaluate themselves as being successful. It defines where they derive acceptance, approbation, and affirmation, things very important to the healthy human. I contend that, again generalizing, most people in the Middle East are most happy and comfortable in their skins when they are functioning within the normative structures of their community. Of course, there are rugged individualists, many of them. But most humans, at the end of the day, are hungry to fit. Let me ground this idea in the specific. I am the emphatic product of an individualist culture that has socialized me to believe that I can and should do what is best for me, and that my broad responsibility is that my exercise of my independence should not infringe or abrogate the rights of others. On this basis, I got up and went to the Middle East, something that nobody in my family or circle had even thought of doing. I married across religious, cultural, national, and linguistic lines. Nobody in my family or my world ever thought I should do anything other than responsibly exercise my individualism. I had a friend in Palestine many years ago, a lovely, well-educated young woman, a professional, much loved and nurtured and supported by her family. She, a Christian, fell in love with a Muslim, a very nice young man. Her family utterly opposed the match, as did his, because of the religious difference. It hurt both of them terribly. But upon consideration, both these sophisticated young people decided that the road to future happiness and contentment did not lie in bucking the system. It lay in working within their community. And frankly, they were right. The point here is that they made decisions about what felt right to them. And those decisions might appear at first blush to the American or Western eye as repression of free will. The conclusion they came to might not have been what would have felt right for me. But I have been raised to be happy in a social construct that many Arabs find lonely and isolating. And you know what? I sometimes find it lonely and isolating. In my life in the Middle East, I have lived through wars, coups, uprisings, suicide bombings, scary encounters with armies and armed groups, and the generally terrifying driving. Of course, when I have come home to visit, I've regularly been asked, "Aren't you afraid?" In fact, of course, there have been times when I have been afraid. But what people are referring to when they ask me that question is what I call the CNN effect. Media has exaggerated reality. Now, I need to say something here. It is important to me, extremely important to me, that I not be interpreted as diminishing the extreme violence and profound suffering in the region. Syria, Iraq, Palestine, Yemen. These are blights on the international conscience. But what I am pointing to is that even in extreme situations, the resilient way in which people go about their business is remarkable. And that the media's fairly exclusive focus on extreme violence does distort the view. And there is definitely a CNN effect when it comes to women and their roles in the Middle East. Let me address some of the issues that, in their presentation in the West, in the way they inform thinking on women's roles and positions in the Middle East, and in the way that they impact programming, do no service and actually great disservice to women in the Middle East. There are a lot of things on this menu, but for tonight's dinner, I would like to serve honor killing, Arab male chauvinism, women's complete disempowerment, women's role in the community, and clothing. On the matter of honor killing, allow me to say as a disclaimer, the phenomenon referred to as honor killing is real and it is terrible. It is in fact highly indicative of what I have been talking about in terms of the construct of Arab societies, where the group value has precedence over individual value, and where the community unit will act to protect itself from what it perceives as harm to that unit. The collective sense of family honor and reputation is a very powerful force, and there are historically strong survival reasons for that. UNFPA reports that there are 5,000 cases of honor killing worldwide, not just the Middle East, worldwide every year. But let's gain a little bit of perspective here. Remember, about 1,500 women are killed annually just in the United States in incidents of domestic violence. Obviously, domestic violence is not an Arab phenomenon or a Muslim one. It is a universal one. And yet, the U.S. administration's recent attempt at a Muslim ban specifically mandated reporting on honor killing by immigrants. As a woman, I find that pretty rich in light of the circumstances. A leadership who sees one sort of assault on women as boy talk and thereby provides a form of permission wants to double down on another kind of assault if it is perpetrated by Muslims. What is really important here, though, is my view, is that this focus on honor killing in the executive order is actually reflective of popular prejudices. Western reporting of honor killing sensationalizes it. Domestic violence should be seen as sensational, sensationally bad, sensationally unacceptable. And yes, it should go without saying that countries in the Arab world should get rid of legislation and practices which are permissive of domestic violence and introduce reform legislation and provide education and enforcement around that legislation. It should be made clear in the Arab world that intentionally killing a family member is simply murder. But the sensationalist, orientalist analysis of honor killing does absolutely nothing to further this goal. I have read articles in which Western observers tried to make the argument that honor killing is not a form of domestic violence, that it is in an especially awful category of its own. The obvious implication is that it is something extra weird committed by those terrible Arabs, and particularly Muslim Arabs. They argue that because the killer can be a brother, a father, a mother, or an uncle, as opposed to a husband, this crime is in a class by itself. Why? If the definition of domestic violence is the inflicting of physical injury by one family or household member on another, then it would seem that honor killing fits. Of course, the whole honor killing palaver feeds off and also nourishes a prejudicial view of the Arab male's chauvinist. Now, yes, generally, societal construct in the Middle East is patriarchal, patrilineal, and patrilocal. And yes, in general, there are societal expectations internalized by men and women alike that men are the head of the family and that authority, particularly in external affairs, vests with them. I am actually not so sure this is so different than the world that I grew up in and a world that I see still exists. But to tell you the truth, with some exceptions, of course, exceptions that I've seen in the Arab world and exceptions that I've seen in the United States, this also is a monochromatic view of the Arab man. The Arab man who is the insensate boss, ready to kill his daughter or sister at the slightest provocation, and indifferent to the dreams and aspirations of the women around him. I don't know this man. I haven't met him in 40 years, immersed in the region. I don't know anyone married to him, or who has him as a father, father-in-law, or brother. I haven't worked with him. I haven't seen him as a beneficiary of programs I've worked on. What I do see is Arabs as individuals, not stereotypes. Each with their own needs and tastes. Each, as we all are, informed by experience and education. So, some men are more rigid than others, and some are more sensitive to the outward appearance of their dominance than others. And this is an important point, the matter of outward appearance. Again, people raised and molded by a community-based society do tend to care about outward appearance because these are indicators of acceptance and approbation. Of course, this concept isn't wholly alien to our own society, but the difference is perhaps a matter of degree. I argue that social appearances do not translate to men who are hard and insensitive. Actually, usually somewhat the contrary. Let me give you an example. A husband may be displeased to learn that when his wife's car broke down in the middle of the road, she simply had it towed and went with it to the garage. The garage being a province of men. In most cases, it's not the tabloid interpretation of, oh, men saw her. It wasn't that he thought she should stand on the road waiting for his orders. It is that he fears the potential perception that he is not taking care of her, resulting in her having to be inconvenienced. And in my experience, more often than not, he really does not want her to be inconvenienced. I am sure many of us would assert that this is paternalistic and somehow denies us equivalence. We might point to the clear engenderment of roles. Why should a man take care of me? Why isn't a woman as competent as a man to go to the garage? This is an individual matter, part of my point. But I wonder if there are many amongst us, male or female, who don't want someone who takes care of us and takes on chores and interfaces with things and places that are perhaps not our particular bailiwick. Which leads me to another stereotype, which is deeply prejudicial and does little or nothing to address the real barriers Arab women experience in accessing their rights. And that is the myth of the Arab or Muslim woman's disempowerment. This stereotype was very powerfully articulated by then-candidate Trump in his backhand reference to Gold Star mother, Mrs. Ghazali Khan. He said, "Look at his wife. She was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me." It is interesting how he seized upon this stereotype of the Muslim woman, when in fact his own wife is a woman whose career has been the marketing of her looks and who is rarely heard from, focusing on her traditional role as homemaker and mother. If someone can tell me where the particularly feminist argument or message is here, please do. Again, yes, women in Arab societies are legislatively disadvantaged. This should be remedied. I pointed to a number of the issues in my introduction. But in my experience in the Arab world, that is not the whole story. In part, because the story of the all-powerful Arab male is not the whole story. Like people everywhere, an Arab woman functions within and manages relationships and social constructs. They are interacting with individuals, not with stereotypes. My experience as a woman in the Arab world and with women in the Arab world is that in general, they do have loci of authority and power. Often the authority and power that comes with traditional roles. Indeed. But is that so different than anywhere else? At the same time, Arab women are also out there. They are educated, professional, entrepreneurial, creative, articulate, and unafraid. They are lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, and bosses. They can and do set agendas. Indeed, over the years, I have known Arab women married to very abusive men. They didn't shut up and accept this as their expectation. They fought back. Oftentimes, the fight back was through traditional means and safety nets. But the point is, they didn't see abuse as a God-given lot. By portraying Arab women in a stereotypical manner, as helpless slaves and concubines in some kind of imagined harem, we also fail to perceive their role in their communities. Women themselves are the most powerful enforcers of societal norms, for good or bad. But whether or not you agree with what the mothers, grandmothers, and aunties are pushing, virginity until marriage, marriage within your own community, the importance of childbearing, men's predominance, acquisitions of skills usually associated with women, you are missing a whole lot if you fail to understand that these women are powerful and do not hesitate to wield their influence. Beyond the personal and societal norm sphere, there is also the very important role that Arab women have played in civil society, community development, and the arts. They have been politically important too, not enough perhaps in the formal national leadership roles, but powerful. I have now spent a lifetime working around the Palestinian struggle, and more recently, the fight of the Syrians to throw off the awful Assad regime. Everywhere I turn, women have been and are involved, committed, taking risks, passionate. More often than not, they are not the frontline warriors. But show me the society where women in the trenches is the norm. Certainly not our own. If we insist on viewing Arab women and men in this very narrow, rigid manner of strong man, subjugated woman, end of story, then we don't understand the Arab world. And if you don't understand something, you are more likely to do harm than good as you interfere. Justice Stevens again. Understand before disagreeing. Women are definitely part of the equation in the Middle East. Which leads me to the final stereotype I would like to address, and the one that just annoys me beyond words. Women's clothing, and most particularly the hijab. The discourse around the hijab bothers me in a lot of ways. Over the last 40 years in the Middle East, I have seen an enormous increase in the wearing of the hijab, and I hear the conservative narrative articulated by various elements in the Arab world, including women. I don't understand why it is that everywhere women seem to be the symbols of nation, culture, religion, politics. And this symbolism gets, in part, expressed by what they wear. But it does seem to be the case. That said, conservative Muslim dress codes, which require covering the body loosely and covering the head, attract an inordinate amount of media attention and commentary. Discussions about whether to ban this piece of clothing or another, and seem to be underpinned by a mass assumption that women aren't exercising will or choice in the matter of how they dress. Now, yes, of course, I know women who have been strongly urged, perhaps against their liking, to wear the hijab. And I have known women who leave the house wearing a hijab and whip it off the minute they get to a part of the town where nobody knows them. However, most women who wear the hijab, and that is a lot of them, do so because it is a standard piece of clothing. And they are comfortable that way. And if you have ever looked carefully at hijabs, you will see they have styles, and the way they are tied and folded can be intricate and beautiful. So the hijab is symbolic, but I am not sure it is symbolic of women's subjugation. And frankly, not a few Arabs, men and women, over the years, have suggested to me that the sexualization of women's dress in the West symbolizes something and represents a form of subjugation and objectification. I can't say that I disagree. One thing I am very certain of is that there is no hard equal sign between wearing the hijab and the disempowerment or subjugation of women. It is for this reason that I find the debates about whether European countries should forbid the hijab in public to be stupid and beside the point. If the French legislated that I could only leave the house in a bikini or a halter top, it would have the effect that I would never leave the house. I would be uncomfortable in the extreme, and my personal decisions about my body would be taken away from me. There is a parallel to the hijab here. So, in trying to ban this piece of Muslim clothing or that one, where is the support for women's agency and empowerment? I love the Middle East. I love the history, the politics, the culture, the language, the food, and I love the people. My experience in the Arab world has been warm, and it has been respectful. It has been tolerant. And I think it's a great place to raise a daughter. In fact, one of the reasons I stayed so long was that I felt it was a wonderful place to raise children of both genders. So why do I see it as so great? Three reasons. First, basically, Arabs like children and welcome them and tolerate them in almost any venue. There is none of the sniffy judgment when you show up at the restaurant with children or the store or your friend's house. On the contrary, The warmth, generosity, and hospitality so characteristic of Arab societies emphatically extends to children, boys, and girls. The community-based society construct also means that everyone is in your business all the time. And this has a happy sidebar of the neighborhood watching out for the children of the neighborhood. As a professional woman and a mother, I have appreciated the liberal approach to children and the community support. Second, it has not been my experience, and I have not observed that it has been my daughter's experience, that we have been relegated to some back seat. My wonderful, feisty Gazan mother-in-law, their grandmother, doted on all the children. She was equally demanding of all of them that they perform in school. She encouraged all of them to learn and explore. Of course, her expectations of my daughters and my sons have been different. But that's fine. She relishes their successes. Of course, my girls' U.S. passports mean that they can transcend the personal status codes that can legislatively impinge Arab women, not to mention the rights abrogations of the Israeli occupation. Third, for boys and for girls, the Arab childhood is a slower childhood. There is no expectation of drugs, alcohol, or sex. The peer pressures in this regard are much, much lower. And that business of the neighbors keeping an eye on your kids, it doesn't stop. Maybe there are people who feel it is an abrogation of rights that Arab boys and girls are expected to forego sexual relations until marriage, which means for most until their 20s. I listened recently to an interview with Peggy Orenstein, the author of Girls and Sex. Her recent research found that 1 in 3 teenage American girls aged 15 to 17 report having given oral sex. Not received it, given it. Where is the equity in attitude here? Where's the equity in practice? And really, how many of you want your girl to think that her relationship with a boy is her providing oral sex? Personally, I fail to hear the rights or the empowerment in this. I hear inequity and disrespect. I have felt that raising daughters in an environment where they were not under pressure of this kind was a good thing. I want to say something about the title of my lecture today, No Place to Raise a Daughter. Of course, I hoped it would get people to come, either to wring their hands over the plight of powerless Arab women, or to flay me alive for my lack of understanding. But more important, many years ago, a colleague of mine very much wanted to accept a position in Jerusalem. He longed to work on Palestinian issues and to learn Arabic. His wife, my friend, a woman of sensitivity and intelligence, put down her foot. Absolutely not. As she said to me about their young daughter, I don't want my daughter brought up in a place that treats women like that. I have puzzled over this remark and her poorly informed view all these years. I understood why she thought the way she did. I applauded her willingness to champion the interests of her girl child, but for the life of me, I simply could not understand what she thought would happen to the child. And I have wished, as one does, that I had been faster on my feet that day over tea to say, wait a minute. So, today I would like to thank Dr. Sarah Roy, Professor Bill Granara, and the Center for Middle East Studies for having provided me the opportunity to say what I should have said all those years ago to my friend. Yes, the position of women is a problem and it needs work everywhere. But do not underestimate the strength, resilience, strategy, and determination of the women of the Arab world. The Middle East is a great place to raise a daughter.
You have been listening to Martha Myers delivering the 6th annual Hilda B. Silverman Lecture at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time and hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.